I'm from the Centre for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation. Thank you firstly just for the opportunity to come and present here. We'd just like to focus on several aspects of the proposed amendment, but more particularly we just want to look at the fact that any sentencing framework, or any sentencing framework, should be equitable, effective, and practicable, which in our situation should also translate into cost effectiveness. It must also be holistic in the sense that it expands across the different components of the criminal justice system. I'm going to speak about three aspects of the legislation in particular, and that is in relation to its impact on crime, in relation to its impact on imprisonment, and in relation to it not being a particularly holistic approach to sentencing. Firstly, in relation to impact on levels of crime. When the minimum sentencing legislation was introduced, it was aimed to have an impact on serious crime, and particularly those that are listed in the legislation deal with murder, rape, robbery with aggravating circumstances, drugs and trafficking, dealing and possession of firearms, indecent assault, etc., etc. Now, if you look at the total number of crimes that have been reported over the last decade, crimes have generally decreased from that period, and they decreased by about 4%. But it's not clear what is driving the overall reduction in crime. However, in the last year, we saw an overall decrease in contact crime, but the most serious forms of contact crime, which was murder and aggravated robbery, as well as arson, increased, as well as the cases relating to illegal possession of firearms. So this is an indication that the minimum sentencing bill doesn't have a direct impact on serious crime. And if one looks at the international literature on remained unchanged. So it's similar trends, but imprisonment rates had declined. So they had chosen a different kind of crime policy. However, more recent research in the United States indicates that incarceration might have some effect on crime rates, but they indicate that only 10% to 25% of the decline in crime rates in the most recent years can be attributed to incarceration. Other factors related to decline in crime rates include the burgeoning economy, decrease in the crack epidemic and related drug offences, drug-related violence offences, community policing, and other kinds of crime prevention and crime policies. It is also argued that the deterrent effect is likely to be more attributable to the certainty of sanction rather than the extent of punishment. And policy initiatives that increase the sentence without addressing the certainty of punishment have a limited deterrent effect. And so in this regard, we need to look at the ability of the police and prosecution to adequately apprehend, investigate, and prosecute crime. Well, we see some issues in conviction rates in the police over the last few years. Conviction rates in the police have improved. But these were attributed to better screening for the death we're wrong for. So we are not absolutely sure to what extent the throughput whether those criminal cases that are affected by the minimum sentencing legislation are better prosecuted as well. There is also little evidence that minimum sentencing can assist in crime prevention through keeping repeated offenders locked up in prison, as not all people convicted of serious violence offences have committed violent crimes before or are likely to commit crime again. Vivian McGuire, citing a British Home Office research reports that these, that those convicted of homicide, only 1 in 6 had previous convictions for violent crimes. And in addition, of over 1,000 persons convicted over a 20-year period and released on license from a life sentence for homicide, only 3% were reconvicted for grave offenses within 5 years and only 1% in 2 years. In addition, those who had been convictions were only half as likely to be reconvicted after they were released. In terms of impact on incarceration levels, as has been said before, this committee, that the size of the prison population and the rate of incarceration has long been a concern in South Africa. The prison population reached an excess of 187,000 in 2005, with overcrowding levels of 160%. But this obviously varied across the country, and some prisons were overcrowded as much as 388%, with obvious implications for the conditions in prison and infringement of various constitutional provisions regarding humane dignity and the other Section 35 rights. In addition, various problems associated with overcrowding, including shortage of staff, space in which to conduct programs, lack of recreational time, the added stress of living in the conditions, etc., compromised the implementation of the Correctional Services White Paper, which basically seeks to rehabilitate and reintegrate people. Although prison numbers have declined to 160,000, this decline and subsequent stability of the population has not been without the artificial means. Since it was achieved mainly through the release of 30,000 inmates in June and August 2005, and there's been a recent bout of releases of people serving minor sentences as well. So, as I said earlier, incarceration levels are much influenced by penal and sentencing policy rather than crime levels. Research by Gifford and Linting, that's the research that's been sponsored by the OSS, reveals that minimum sentencing legislation does have an impact or has interesting results. The overall number of admissions of sentenced prisoners to prison has declined since 2000, while the total population has increased up to June 2005. The number of admissions to prison for short-term sentences has decreased from 2002, indicating that the lower courts are less reluctant to send people to imprisonment for less serious crimes, and this probably contributes to reducing the number of imprisonments. But in contrast, the number of admissions of inmates serving sentences of more than 10 years is increasing, and a growing proportion of the inmate population are serving longer prison terms. And indeed, it is seen that the longer sentences are increasing at a fastest rate. Munting and Gifford attribute this to two factors, and the one is the Magistrates Court Amendment Act, which increased the jurisdiction of the Magistrates Court, the districts and the regional courts, as well as the minimum sentencing legislation, both of which were implemented in 1998. There was a 2-year...
Just wind up because you're over here.
In relation to the overcrowding, I think one needs also to look at the parole provisions, because that is also contributing to the overcrowding problem. People are serving longer sentences in prison, and this will have a cumulative effect over a number of years as the minimum sentencing legislation is in place. The parole legislation, which stipulates that people sentenced in terms of minimum sentencing legislation should serve 4/5 of their sentence for 25 years, means that people are in prison for longer periods of time. The big problem around overcrowding is that in order to deal with the problem of overcrowding, the Parliament has had to deal with it, or ministers have to deal with the problem of overcrowding through ad hoc releases, which is in effect undermining of the sentencing and the jurisdiction of the courts. And this, we see that this problem is going to increase if the minimum sentencing legislation is in place. In addition, one needs to look at the cost of incarcerating greater numbers of people and also for longer and longer periods of time. This is going to have enormous cost implications for the state. The state will have to continue with its prison building program, which is already way behind what the projected numbers of prisoners are. But they will also have to be providing for people who are an aging population. Presumably there'll be medical aid, medical expenses, etc. And the minimum knows the memorandum to amendment made no indication of the imagined cost implications of the Act, and I think that this is one possible shortfall.
Thanks very much. We've got your written submission, so we'll pay more attention to some of the other issues that you've raised as well. The idea behind the oral submission is really for you to highlight those areas that you're most concerned with. And from what you seem to be essentially honing in on is the deterrent effect or lack thereof as far as minimum sentences are concerned, and secondly, your prison population. Now, your entire submission seems to be based on this issue of deterrence, and that there doesn't seem to be empirical evidence that your most serious crimes are declining. But clearly there isn't evidence to the contrary either. And so again, it's not based on empirical evidence, it's merely anecdotal. Secondly, as far as the prison population is concerned, I'm not sure if you were here earlier, but we had some substantive discussions on it, as to whether in fact the overcrowding is due to the minimum sentences. The Open Society Foundation found that in fact the minimum sentences did not contribute necessarily to the overcrowding, but that it is projected to cause a imaginable effect going into the future. Now, my question to you is, you make some emphatic statements about the overcrowding and its relationship to minimum sentences. And what do you base that? On what empirical evidence do you base that? I'm going to ask other members as well if they have any questions. Dr. Galpo?
Thank you. If I may say so, dispose of the overcrowding argument. Would you say our prison capacity is too low, or is our number of prisoners too high? I mean, overcrowding is a relative term. Overcrowding in terms of what? In terms of the existing capacity. And then the deterrent effect. We have some studies indicate that even the death penalty is not a proper deterrent effect. Simply the perpetrator does not envisage eventually that he's going to be hanged or be sent to prison. He thinks he's committing a perfect crime. So I think it's more about, and I would like to comment, about how the people out there perceive the attempts by Parliament to restrict crime, to do something about crime. Because one thing we must guard against is that people take the law into their own hands. And we've had examples. And that's what's going to happen if the present crime level is perpetuated.
Chairperson, please correct me what Dr. Double has just said. But I mean, over and over again, we get these two issues. The current effect is the overcrowding. And I don't see the connection between this piece of legislation and these two matters. See, the reasons are somewhere else. The reasons are somewhere else. I mean, if we go back, for example, to the two-tier system which we had, right, would that, for example, I don't think so, you see, right, make it improve the deterrent effect? It won't. It just won't, you see. The reasons for increasing crime are somewhere else in that context. Right. Somebody was overcrowding, you see. Right. This is a comment I want to make.
Okay, let's see.
Thank you. This issue of overcrowding and sentencing, I think that one can't really separate it. As I've tried to start off by presenting that a sentencing framework should be a holistic approach which is affordable and which the whole state supports and can implement. The problem with the existing sentencing framework is that in large numbers of people are sent to prison that the correctional services can't cope with and respond by releasing them on special remission of sentences because the state is currently unable to afford and accommodate
people. But explain this to me. See, I don't understand the logic of it. You're arguing for a comprehensive framework which will cover all crimes. that doesn't necessarily mean that they will be lesser crimes, I mean lesser sentences imposed in terms of those frameworks. The idea behind the sentencing framework, to me it seems, is consistency. Now, it does not imply that you're going to now not imprison people. What is the rationality or the link between what you're arguing?
I think that, and thank you for pointing that out, because I think I wasn't clear on that, but a sentencing framework, I think, needs to develop a sentencing tariff, which the state is going to be able to implement. And to some extent, I don't think that the state has actually grappled with how many people can be sentenced for what the sentence or for how many years. And the minimum sentencing approach prescribes certain kind of sentencing or certain tariff, but it hasn't actually looked at what the state can actually accommodate.
Now, look, I don't think you're going to find an argument. And you may be very, very correct when you start saying things like perhaps our facilities are insufficient in terms of correctional facilities, perhaps we need to introduce rehabilitation programs, all of those things. I don't think you'll find much argument there. The issue is when you start attacking the minimum sentences and linking it to the capacity, that you have to start asking the question, what is the link? What is the link in the sense that if a crime is perpetrated and it's a serious crime, and the intention, by the way, is not just about deterrence. The deterrent value is certainly there, but it's a gamut of objectives when you start implementing a sentencing regime, one of which is removal from society, to protect society. Another one being consistency or consistently higher sentences for serious crimes. Now, those are the objectives. And if it's true, and it may very well be, that our capacity in terms of incarceration and rehabilitation and so on needs improvement, then surely that's where the attack should be. The entire critique should be, what do we need? Or the question first should be, how much more do we need than we currently have in terms of capacity, in terms of resources, in terms of human and other kinds of things?
I mean, I think it's a mixture of both, if you allow me to disagree. I think that the state needs to say holistically how much can we afford to sentence people for a range of different crimes. These particular tariffs have been arrived at. It's not clear how they've been arrived at, the amounts that have been prescribed according to this legislation. And it's not being set out in the memorandum or arguments in relation to
this. Would you agree, for example, that your Part 1 crimes are probably the most serious crimes you'll find? I mean, if you agree with that, then clearly you have to agree that the intention of the legislature is that the most serious crimes must be visited with the most serious punishment. It can't be how many people can we afford to sentence to life imprisonment, and therefore we will not impose such. It can't be that. I mean, that's not how criminal justice system works.
Well, if I recall, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're arguing that there needs to be a comprehensive sentencing framework which can address all the crimes across the
region. Which will not necessarily mean lower sentences.
It might mean lower sentences, it might not, but I think that I would like to suggest that it still needs to be looked at so that they can be addressed comprehensively.
Okay, let's deal with the other matter.
You asked, what is the linkage between overcrowding and prison capacity? You argued that the OSF has found there was no direct linkage.
Minimum sentencing and overcrowding.
The OSF research had been done in 2005, which was 5 years after we had seen the beginning of the increasing imprisonment, after the implementation of the minimum sentencing legislation and the increase in the magistrate's jurisdiction. So that allows for a 5-year period. If you take the minimum sentencing in terms of this legislation, that is from 7 years and then obviously up until life. So we won't see the impact, you wouldn't have seen the impact of minimum sentencing yet on the overcrowding, but you will see this incrementally over a number of years to come. And in the report that the OSF did, there is the R prediction done, which were made, which talk about what the expected increase in the population will be.
But again, that is not necessarily empirical. It's dependent on a number of factors, one of which, by the way, is the extent to which serious crime is reduced in this country.
Sure.
And that's not something that you can predict.
That's not something you can predict, but I think the projections were made. Obviously, they have to take into account a number of factors.
What would you say to the argument that our judiciary seems to be at pains to veer away from minimum sentences? And so, in fact, the kind of sentences that we do see are very, the percentage of high sentences that we do get is actually minuscule.
That's not what we're seeing in that as it's reflected in the prison rates. As I said, the sentences that are higher than 10 years, sentences more than 10 years, and sentences more than 15 years, and life imprisonment sentences have increased dramatically over the last 5 years.
But you can't say that those are sentenced in terms of the minimum sentences legislation.
Well, I mean, it's not clear whether magistrates or the High Court would have seen it would be specifically in terms of the minimum.
Well, that's what I'm asking for. I'm asking for the link between minimum sentences and the increase.
One would have to do proper docket analysis to see whether the sentencing court did match that dilemma. But certainly, if you have legislation which determines what should be the minimum sentence for a certain type of crime, that is going to establish some kind of sentencing precedent, even if it's not necessarily determined. It is going to be, have the effect, I would imagine, of pushing up the general.
My sense is this, you see, and this is how I respond to that argument. If we repeal this legislation tomorrow, for these serious crimes, you're still going to get pretty harsh sentences emanating from our courts because of the serious nature of the crime, not because minimum sentences set the standard. And that's really the problem with the kind of evidence that you're producing here today, that it's not empirical. It's anecdotal, it's projections based on a fear of increased sentences based on some kind of standard that you think people are imposing. But that isn't empirical evidence.
Well, it is empirical evidence because they change analysis according to statistics, and maybe and talk about this, sorry, not the name. But there are change analysis, which is a form of empirical research.
But how do you project into the future based on an unknown factor, such as the reduction in serious crimes being committed, for example?
Well,
you can only do it on the basis of current change.
Well,
and we're hoping, clearly, with the efforts in the criminal justice system and the crime prevention efforts and so on, that those will kick in over time. So again, you have a problem and a difficulty in terms of predicting into the future because there's a big unknown factor, surely.
Of course, but one should predict into the future on the basis of the current reductions or the current crime trends as well, and not just imagine that with expected efforts on the criminal justice system that the crime rate will reduce. It hasn't shown that trend, and there's obviously a number of factors, as one of the other members pointed out, that are driving the crime rate at the moment. So I don't think that we're in a position to assume that crime is going to come down significantly. And what I'm trying to draw the relationship between the fact that it's not crime which determines imprisonment rates, but these are independent, but it's crime policy which really has an impact on imprisonment rates. And so the department which basically has the primary responsibility for things. Just to illustrate the point about other offenders, I know that you did make a point about the parole institution and the proposed amendment to the Correctional Services Act, which seeks to amend Section 736BV, which removes all of the parole legislation currently in the Correctional Services Act. Sets a minimum that a person should spend in prison before they are considered for parole. The proposed legislation removes that criteria and leaves it at the discretion of the minister, which I think is something that is going to be unworkable across the system. It's not a holistic way of doing things.
Yeah, we've invited them to make that decision from that. Okay. Anything further? Okay. Members, anything further on this matter? Okay, thank you. Oh, okay, Emma.
And this is one point regarding this prison population and the overcrowding. There's one thing which is quite clear to me from this legislation. that because of the process now, it's much shorter, and it's collapsed down into one, right? That sensitive will take place with the other, you know, sensitive with after sound in the regional court, that the awaiting time for the population will certainly be reduced. And that is quite obvious.
Thanks for pointing. Well, it's possible that the waiting trial...
I wasn't going to give you another interview. I think it was a comment. Okay, thank you very much. And we will of course, be looking at your written submission a lot more. I see that you haven't touched on one of the more important aspects of your submission, which is the issue of jurisdiction extension for the regional church, which is a pity because that's certainly something that's using us a bit more than things like the issues that you were raising. But we will of course use your comments when we further consider and deal with the legal arguments and so on. Thank you very much for coming here. The analyst, I believe. I don't know how to say this word. I don't even know where it comes from. But, how do you say this word? Say it loud.
Shakala Pila.
Can you say 50 times in a row? I see that a lot of the submissions have actually drawn on some of your research as well, and so we thought we might want to engage with you on some of those matters. I suggest you take about 10 minutes to just take us through your submissions and findings, and then we'll engage with you further. I also want you to please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. My name is Jean Redpath. I'm from Shlakana Pila Analytics. My colleague Michael O'Donovan will also be presenting today. We spent about 9 months last year looking into the impact of minimum sentencing. We won't really be going into our findings of that report as it's widely available, and I believe this committee has already had sight of it. We'll just be concentrating on three main points that we'd like to make today that arose from the research. The first is that our docket analysis that we covered in the research showed us that there was still a great deal of inconsistency in sentencing despite the passing of the minimum sentencing law. From even within the same court, very wide-ranging sentences were passed. And clearly minimum sentencing legislation hasn't helped to address this problem, and simply making it a permanent law will not solve the problem either. We just have some data illustrating the point. We're not talking about a docket analysis here, but if we just look at, for example, incarceration rates by race, we can already see that sentencing is playing a role here. These figures cannot be explained by prosecutions, by levels of criminality among the race groups. There's something going on with sentencing when we have the colored race group 10 times more likely to be in prison as the Asian race group. And this cannot be totally explained by crime rates, by prosecution rates among the different provinces. When we look at among the provinces, we find, for example, of those serving 15 plus years, there are something like 3 times as many per 100,000 citizens in the Free State as there are in Mpumalanga. This is clearly showing that there's a difference in the way the courts in the Free State are dealing with people as the way in the courts in Mpumalanga. Another thing to note is in the Western Cape, a very small proportion of all people who are in prison for 15 plus years, but in Limpopo, it's something like a third. There's obviously a wide range of sentencing patterns across across provinces, within courts, there needs to be a comprehensive intervention to try to begin to fix this problem of inconsistency. Now, I know there's been a lot of controversial talk today already about the issue of overcrowding. What we're more concerned about is if this committee is really concerned about people going to prison in terms of what a court has decided is the appropriate sentence, then simply making minimum sentencing permanent is not going to help that. Increasing the regional court's jurisdiction is certainly, we saw that when it was increased before, it's certainly going to lead to more people being in prison for longer and more frequent early releases from prison. This is simply because the proportion of people in prison who are serving long sentences is getting higher and higher. So these releases will increasingly include heavier sentences. And it will be the Department of Correctional Services who is making a decision on how long people should stay in prison, rather than our judicial officers who are supposed to be the ones making that decision. And we've already seen the trend on the next slide. You will see these are monthly releases from prison in all sentence categories above a year. We haven't included a year because obviously people who are sent for a year are released within that year. What you see here is approximately every 2 to 3 years there's a peak, and you will note that peak is in all sentence categories. It's not true that it's only minor offenders who are released early. The very broad peak you can ignore, that's in 2001, where a lot of people were released and placed in new prisons at open. But the other sharp peaks that we're looking at there, they include releases in all sentence categories. And that's going to increasingly increase the longer sentences. Look at the next part as well. Again, you can ignore 2001, but you'll see that the overall trend, this is the percentage of prisoners released serving more than 7 cut years, and we can see the steady increase from 1995 to 2005. Now, you may say that this is not just about minimum sentencing, but certainly our research with judicial officers, they were very clear that, in fact, minimum sentencing had they should sentence to a higher degree. They did feel guided by the legislation, and they felt that they couldn't deviate too far from what the legislature had laid down. And certainly, as far as we're concerned, minimum sentencing has had an impact on how judicial officers sentence. My colleague will continue with the last slide.
Good afternoon. I want to pick up on a point that was made by the two of the honourable members here, and that is really what the role of the legislation is. Essentially what the legislation does is send a signal to society as to what behaviour is acceptable and acceptable. And the minimum sentence legislation is quite unequivocal in this regard. Rape, murder with firearms, etc. are being sent the message quite clearly that these crimes will result in extremely heavy penalties. Notwithstanding this, what actually transpires in the long run is not merely a function of legislation. It's also a function of ancillary factors. Key one, which keeps coming up, is the impact on overcrowding, the periodic releases. That plays a large role in determining how long people actually spend in prison. In our document, we go through a whole range of things like the impact on plea bargaining, demand for legal aid, the size of the court backlog, and so on. But essentially, if we think of minimum sentencing as signaling to criminals what behavior is acceptable or not, and use it as a basis for extending minimum sentences, we have to broaden the way that we think about this to include those types of crimes that are not covered by the minimum sentence legislation. If you look at the graph I've just put up, what you can see from here quite clearly is that, first of all, the tariff for crime is getting heavy. It's getting heavier. But also what is happening is that the number of people that are being prosecuted and incarcerated for so-called lesser crimes is reducing markedly. So although over 50% of our prison population now serves in excess of 5 years, you have to consider when we're doing the legislation. What's happening to those prisoners, to those people convicted, that would have been convicted of a sentence of less than 5 years? Now, the general picture is that overcrowding, the periodic releases, the backlogs in the courts, are making it increasingly likely that people accused of lesser offences will not be prosecuted. If prosecuted, will not be incarcerated. Therefore, put to you the question, what signal is Parliament then sending to those that are accused, tried, of assault, of so-called ordinary murder? Are those crimes that would, in the past, have attracted a 2-year, a 3-year, a 5-year sentence? Are we not signaling through the way that this mechanism transpires that they are likely to get a free ride? Thank you.
This last suggestion of yours that people are being crowded out and that lesser sentences don't get prosecuted, where does that come from? Is there empirical evidence of that? And, by the way, is it necessarily a bad thing? And I'm not talking about assault and so on, but others would argue that when it is a lesser crime, that alternatives other than imprisonment should be considered.
The comments that we're making here are really made in a rather mixed environment, in the sense that on the one hand we have clear legislation. On the other hand, most people thinking is that there's this incredible capacity to divert lesser offenders. That alternative sentencing is a viable alternative. In the absence of the massive infrastructure required for diversion, for alternative sentencing, we can only assume that this, in excess of 50% of the population, that would have got less than 5 year sentence, they cannot be diverted. You don't have, the capacity is not there for them to be diverted. The capacity is not there for the alternative sentencing. And that's why I put out the question. If they're not there, where are they?
But what about the average brawl in a Shabin? I mean, that was stopped. People punching each other and so on. You get to court, you plead guilty, and the judicial officer gives you a fine. What is so harmful in that kind of, I mean, what is it that you're arguing for? Are you arguing that those kinds of cases should also be sent to prison, but for, 5 years later? I mean, I'm not going
to... No, we're certainly not arguing that.
Yeah.
What we're arguing is that the legislation must be informed, not only by the impact, the legal sense with regard to the schedule of the sentence. The legislation must be also informed by what happens to the other offenders. Now, you should be able to answer the question, what happens to the other crimes?
The legislation is very focused.
Yes.
Very focused, as all other mandatory sentencing legislation is throughout the world, on very specific crimes. Now, You can argue what you're arguing now if you're talking about the sentencing framework, which is a more holistic piece of legislation, something that deals comprehensively with both your less serious, your medium serious, and your very serious cases. But in this instance, and And it seems to me that if you're going to have a mandatory mandatory sentencing legislation, but that is always, throughout the world, wherever you go, always very focused on the specific crime.
I just wanted to pick up on the example you gave about the Shireen Law. In fact, a lot of the murders for which 15 years prescribed arise from the Shireen Law. So in one instance where someone is lucky enough to miss an archery and they get a fine, in another instance they go away for 15 years. Now I know in the past, legislators routinely sentenced murders arising from Shireen Law fraud to 7 years or 6 years. That was generally the trend until minimum sentencing came into play. Now again, maybe some magistrates are sentencing in the old way. We have this huge problem of inconsistency, and what we really are arguing for is just that the question of sentencing not be put to bed with the passage of this legislation. That we really need a comprehensive overhaul of sentencing in general, maybe a whole new approach that will deal with these problems of inconsistency, that will take into account what signals are being sent for necessary sentencing, that will take into account the capacity of our prison system, so that we are putting away the really evil murderers who are likely to offend again for life. And will Shireen, the 19-year-old Shireen Gordon, make a mistake, perhaps not for 15 years, but perhaps for 7 years or 6 years?
Now, the
going in a very kind of concave way. I don't see anything significant there in terms of the kinds of things that you're arguing in terms of what is the impact of the minimum sentence system in terms of sentencing patterns generally.
Okay, if you look at the graph, you see the top 1, 2, 3, 4 bars. These are the people serving 10 years or more in prison. It's gone from perhaps 12% of the prison population in 95 to 40% of the prison population in 2005. These are your crimes targeted by minimum sentence legislation. So, and this...
How do you get to that conclusion? Because 1995 didn't have a minimum sentence legislation.
Yes.
And the impact of minimum sentence arguably, I wouldn't even say completely, because if it was implemented when in 98, but the effect of that would clearly only be seen thereafter. And so, let's just say in 1999 is when you start seeing the effect of it. Now, that thing shows a consistency for me, if you see what I'm saying. You have a growing number of, for example, if you look at your middle category, that 80%, because that's what you're arguing. You're saying that, I'm not sure what color that is. Let's call it green. There's two green bars in the middle of it. Those are your sentences that you want to suggest to us that have really impacted significantly or had significantly impact or was significantly impacted on by the introduction of minimum sentences. Because those are your medium categories. But what I'm saying to you is, I don't see too much of a difference.
There are a number of factors that are coming to play here. First of all, is expanded jurisdiction of the regional court. and this was in 98, in approximately 98. So those courts were then able, were in a position to impose severe penalties. Prior to that fact, the tariff for centers had been increased. Now, when the minimum legislation is passed, you don't have this massive whammy. It is introduced gradually into the judicial system. It's a slow-moving animal by definition. And just to reset what I was saying, that those categories 10 years and above are really the type of crimes that are targeted by the minimum sentence legislation. You know, hopefully those are the crimes, the serious crimes warrant the heavier sentences, and these are the crimes that you are targeting. So, the point that we want to make here is that it is twofold. Okay, so if I can just step back onto this. Okay, so it's the wrong one. Sorry, this is the wrong one. The total number of convictions passed by the court has been declining consistently since 1998. Beginning a smaller number of convictions. The total number of people being admitted to prison is dropping by a similar proportion. So we're sending fewer people to court. Fewer people are being convicted. Fewer people are being incarcerated. But of those people that are being incarcerated, they have at least a 50% chance now of having more than a 5-year sentence. So our prisons are now being populated overwhelmingly by people with heavy sentences. And obviously this has an impact on DCS in terms of the security levels, etc. that's required of them. So once again, I want to pose the question to you, is that what happened to those people that would have been convicted of a crime that would stop less than 5 years? They, essentially, they did not appear to be entering the system. So what signals are we sending?
So, I mean, the bulk of those people are the bottom blue.
Yes.
So there they are.
Yes, but they've dropped from 55% down to 30-odd% of the population.
But I'm suggesting to you that is, it doesn't seem on the face of it to be enormously significant. Now, why is it that you're suggesting that it is significant? I'm trying to understand the link between what you're saying is caused by the minimum sentences. On the one hand, you seem to be suggesting that the impact on the judiciary is such that they're going to start getting heavier sentences, going down your medium range. But when it comes to your very small, your petty crimes, people are not being included. My question to you is, is that so bad that people who are perpetrating petty crimes are not ending up in our prisons?
We tend to get this scenario in the report where really the whole gamut of things come together associated with minimum sentence. So one is prison overcrowding, accept that or not. The other one is the longer term, the greater number of appeals, the time between first appearance and conviction. These are all increasing dramatically. So the judicial system is, as you're well aware, is slowing down. It is taking longer to get to the conviction. If you are confronted with a minimum sentence, you have no incentive to enter a plea bargain, or very little incentive to enter a plea bargain. Therefore, the system is slowed down in that regard. You've got every incentive to appeal a minimum sentence. So, all this adds to the burden on the judicial system, let alone the prison system. Now, your coupled to inconsistency would obviously give people a ground for or give them the impression that they've
gone for appeal. Now, the additional burden on the court system thinking what you refer to as hedge funds. But by no means of imagination does a crime that attracted a part of the attention 5 to 10 years ago could be deemed sentenced. Obviously, plenty of offences must be divergent. Alternative sentencing should be explored.
But that presupposes once again that you have the infrastructure in place for diversion, for alternative sentencing. And we do not see the evidence of that infrastructure. Now, I'll just get back to my point. Yes, minimum sentence legislation is clearly a very large target in the international experience. And that it does specify particular crimes or particular type of crime. But what we are arguing here is that you cannot use those types of crimes in isolation, either from the court system or the civil system.
Now, I hear your argument. Let me just ask you one final question on this matter, and then we'll leave it at that. As part of the various factors you said, for example, you took into account your prison population and so on when you factored the staff in. One of the things that you, I guess, also factored in is the increase in the capacity of the police, for example, and the increase in the capacity of the prosecution authority during the same period in question.
Yes, we know that the number of dockets that the police is sending
to the prosecuting authority each year is around 500,000, and it's been slowly increasing. However, the prosecuting authority is only able to prosecute on average each year about 330,000. So they're routinely turning away and they are not able to do more than that. So it doesn't really matter how many dockets
the police throw at them. There is a finite capacity, and that capacity is decreasing as the burden on the courts, as people appeal, use legal aid, do anything they can do to escape minimum sentences, has its impact on the courts.
What I'm saying is that the number of serious offences that are being charged at our level at each court would therefore concomitantly increase with the capacity of the that is, I know that one of the things that we have encountered in our discussion today and certainly in many of the submissions is the fact that the issue of substantial and compelling circumstances seems to be. Maybe you want to explain and expand on those a little bit more for us so that we can see, and maybe give us some insight as to what the possible reasons may be that you might have understood.
We don't know what the reasons are for these very different trends. We looked into levels of serious crime, to try to explain them. We looked into number of courts per province to try to explain them, and none of these really seem to explain the trends that you see here on this graph. We can only assume that there are very different ways of doing things in the various divisions, and that very different trends are being followed. And we know from our docket analysis that even within provinces, very different decisions can come out of within provinces. From a perusal of the case law, there's been very different interpretations in the provinces of substantial and compelling circumstances. So that might be part of the explanation. But really, what we're just trying to show is that there does seem to be a problem. We don't know all the reasons for the problems, and the obvious answers, like levels of serious crime, number of courts, don't seem to be answering the questions of these different trends.
I admittedly, this is probably more a speculation and fear speaking, but I would hazard guess that in the free state, judges and magistrates are less inclined to deviate from the specified minimum. And perhaps in the other provinces, they're more inclined to deviate. But either way, whatever the reason is, what the end result of your conviction should not depend on which province you're convicted in. Should not really depend on your skin color.
Of course, that you would see a bigger deviation if it wasn't from the minimum. That would also be a speculative discount.
On the contrary, we found pretty clear trends amongst judicial officers of what they used to sentence. You know, what they call the shagreen, brawl, murder, 7 years, rape, 2 years. So those were the kinds of sentences that were passed. With the introduction of minimum sentencing, we have some judicial officers who are simply ignoring minimum sentencing, sticking to the old trends, and then you have others applying the new sentences. So instead of 7 years, someone is now getting 15 years. So what we found is that the range of sentences passed for the same crime in the similar circumstances has become much wider than it was before. Some may say that's a good thing, we needed to raise the bar. In fact, judicial officers said that certainly they were sensitized that rape needed to be sentenced to a stronger degree. But that rape was an exception. Rape seems to have come out as being more consistent, but amongst all other crime types, the range, particularly in Part 1 offenses, has become much, much greater.
Before I accept your testimony on what happened prior to the minimum sentences, I'm going to ask for empirical evidence, because my sense is, given our history, given the enormous racial tensions, and then you've pointed to race as well, I can't imagine that you would have consistent sentences being preferred in your court prior to the minimum sentences. In fact, that was one of the big issues. And it's not just an issue of saying that there were lesser sentences being passed for more serious cases, but also that depending on where you were in the country, you would see more possibility of your getting life or even the death sentence as it was prior to this legislation. It was probably at an optimum level. So if you do have stuff like that, maybe you can submit it to us. Because you see, one of the biggest concerns that we have with the sentencing framework as well is that it still maintains the substantial and compelling issue. And if you are going to proceed with an exercise that is meant to be a comprehensive framework for sentencing, one of the issues that you hopefully would want to derive from that exercise is consistency. And if you have an element, as you're now showing us, I mean, it's something that we've suspected all along, that substantial and compelling allows a huge deviation and really contradicts the kind of consistency objective that we've had in the past with the legislation. You then retain it for the sentencing framework, you're not achieving much in terms of consistency. And that's certainly what is being proposed by the Law Commission at the moment. I don't know if any members want to add anything further on this matter. Mrs. Marusi. Okay. Excuse me, just thank you very much for your submission. And as I said, we will be looking at this in fine detail when we proceed to the role further. Thank you. Who do we have from the prosecuting authority? Won't you guys come out this way? Come down to intimidate the committee. They clearly are more members of the NPA here than members of the committee. Oh well, then they just out of the book. Okay, when you're ready.
Thank you, Chairperson. We do have a written submission that I'm going to talk to. We're not quite as organized as to have a PowerPoint today, but I think it will help. It will help if members have the written submission in front of them. Chair, maybe I should start by one comment on some of the previous submissions. I think that there's no doubt that the minimum sentencing has had an impact on sentences. But I think the impact has by far been the greatest on age sentences. I think that the previous submissions, or some of my colleagues said, often for age sentences were 2 years or even suspended sentences. So I think that it has certainly had a significant impact on rape sentences, and given that rape cases are about 30% of the cases of the regional court, I think that probably accounts for a significant change in some of the sentencing patterns that we see. But whether doing away with the minimum sentences would actually mean the sentencing patterns would reverse to what they were before, I don't think so. I think that it's been part of a general recognition in society that sentencing was inadequate before. Chairman, if I can just take you through our submission, and let me say that generally the NPA would like to just to bring to the attention of the committee some of the logistical difficulties that would arise with giving regional courts life sentence jurisdiction. We can deal with some of those, but we do think that in some of those areas a little bit more engagement is required. So on page 2 of our submission, I think we just make the point in paragraph and the first paragraph that we don't foresee any constitutional difficulties. But in paragraph 8, what we are a little bit concerned about is that the procedure may end up creating a bigger burden in the court, particularly the result. I think the intention of the legislature here is not to change the existing pattern, where most cases where a life sentence is envisaged is charged in the High Court rather than in the Regional Court. I think, as we understand the scheme of the amendment, it's really to say where a case has been charged in the Regional Court and it then emerges that the life sentence is warranted, how do we deal with that gap? But I think our concern would be if the result of the legislation is that more cases where life sentences warranted become charged in the regional court, it would create a range of logistical difficulties, partly because of lack of continuous role.
And then in paragraph B, the fact that there would be compulsory appeals in all these cases as well. But I'll come back to that issue later when we deal with the guidelines. I think we have made the point that if it's not
the verdict that has happened of where people are charged should change, it may be important in the legislation or with a memorandum to give some indication of that. I think
in terms of paragraph B, you talked earlier in some of the other submissions about the possibility of review. We have had some discussion ourselves, and we believe that instead of a compulsory appeal in cases where life sentence is imposed, that it may be worth, if this is not in our submission at the moment,
that it may be worth rather doing an automatic review of those sentences. It's a quicker process, it means one judge rather than two judges. It's explained that it is on the record, that there's no recording of witnesses and so on, and it can happen in chambers rather than in court. We're not saying that the person should not have the right to appeal, but obviously they would still have a right to appeal, but there'd be an automatic review rather than so we would like the committee perhaps just to consider that as an option in terms of what is currently in the book. And that I think deals with some of the points that we then make in paragraph C about the volume of work that may be generated from an automatic appeal process which now is examined in paragraph C. In paragraph D, we highlighted some of the difficulties that may be foreseen in relation to us in the process of the policy about the decisions about where to charge the person. As you will see later, I think if it comes to prosecuting guidelines, our guidelines would probably be to the effect that if it's foreseen or in our opinion foreseen that the life sentence is imposed, the matter should be involved in the jurisdiction for the regional court to impose life sentences are really just to catch those cases where it only becomes plain during argument or during the course of the trial that the life sentence may be required. In paragraph E, we deal with what I think is a significant part of the problem for us and the courts in general at the moment. And that is that at the moment, essentially all Part 1 matters are referred to the High Court for sentence. Even if the magistrate may be of the opinion that there is indeed substantial and concurring circumstances, and that therefore he or she could have imposed a 10 or 15 year sentence, it still goes to the High Court for sentence. So we do believe that it's important to have a clear provision in the law that makes it very clear that where the magistrate finds substantial and compelling reasons, the magistrate can dispose of the matter. The jurisdiction is also given, as we see in some of them, to make that clear. But that, as you would have seen from the report just by Patrick McCook from our case on office, is that about 90% of the cases, and that's the same general pattern nationally, that it's only in about 10% of the referring matters are imprisonment in this case. And it's really those 10% only that should have been referred, but instead all 90% are being referred in the matter. So we believe that even just a single amendment would make a huge difference to the workload that the back offices are occasioned in the High Court finally proposing. I think the anomaly here at the moment as well, and I think its impact on what is finally proposed, is that to think the theme of the act is to say, we should hear evidence of sentencing and then make a finding on whether there is or is not a compelling circumstance. If there is not, they sentence. If there is, they effectively sentence it if we deserve life to fight on the third sentence. And therefore the referral mechanism would have been necessary. We still believe in that has there to be a fact of the we should consider the same as the referral mechanism. Just because of some of the logistic rules. But we accept the system that we advocate that the sentencing should happen so subject to some safe form. Again, as I said, the review procedure may be willing to make it with options to consider. In paragraph 10 on page 5, then we do just give you some of the statistics about this recursive. What we then go on to say is, this would be on the basis of there could be some referral mechanism that has been made clear that sentencing can happen when there is substantial and compelling circumstances. The top of page 6 is just the consequence of that is clearly confers the jurisdiction on the court to, for part 1 offences, to impose those sentences. One of the issues that we would like to suggest as well for the committee to look at is at the moment there is a general law saying that confers on the regional court the discretion of the minimum sentence prescribed plus 5 years. I think in terms of some of the submissions that were made earlier by the regional court delegation. There are certainly cases where somebody is charged with rape and the prescribed sentence is only 10 years, but where a 20 or a 25 year sentence may be warranted. I think the example of a grandmother that faced with really aggravating circumstances.
And we would not think that in those cases you want to refer them to the High Court to sentence. And we're not sure that the present proposal deals comprehensively with cases like that, because it needs either to confer some jurisdiction on the court to impose a sentence there, or you would need a referral mechanism for sentencing in another court. So there is still a difficulty around that. I think our suggestion would be that plus 5 years should perhaps be increased to plus 10 or plus 15 years, but that is still an issue that needs to be thought about, is where somebody is charged with a normal rape with really serious aggravating circumstances. Where would be the authority for a more serious sentence, or would those cases still end up being referred to the High Court? They're not a large number of cases, but it is just an issue that I think the present amendments do not deal with comprehensively. In the middle of page 6, we just draw attention to the fact that there is a provision in the Prevention of Organized Crime Act dealing with racketeering offences that was sort of tied to the fact that the regional courts do not have a mandate to impose life imprisonment. And that we will happy to engage with the drafters here, but one may well want to remove that qualification but then it would need to be made clear that for racketeering a life sentence could also be imposed. But we don't have a concrete answer or suggestion here, we're just saying that is an issue that should be considered, especially if the referral for sentence notion is going to be disposed of. Then concretely, I think I've dealt with our suggestions on each clause. Just on page 7, paragraph 4, it's really just a technical amendment, but we do say to talk about an accused person rather than just a person. That's generally the terminology used in the Act. On paragraph 6, in terms of the guidelines, I have already indicated that we do foresee some difficulty around the guidelines. I think our suggestion after some further thought is that it may help us if there's some indication in the law what the intention of the legislature is here. But essentially what we would propose as the guidelines, I think, is on... I think the guidelines that are likely to come would be one that says something like, in the opinion, if an opinion of the prosecuting authority, this case warrants or may fall within the a case where life imprisonment is warranted, it should be charged in the High Court. So I've dealt with that issue before, but we may need some legislative intent to be a little bit more clear in that. Because we are worried about some arguments that may be raised around equality issues and so on. If we have too large a discretion about which, you may end up with similar cases, some being charged in the High Court, some being charged in the Regional Court. So I think we don't want those matters to be entirely left to the NPA discretion or to policy guideline discretion. The last point that we wanted to make was just a technical one again, that there is a difference between prosecution policy and policy directives, and that should just be clear in the language. I think what we're talking here about is policy directives that are issued from time to time by the National Director or the DDGs in their different divisions. I think just one last issue to make clear to the committee is that the issue of secondary victimization is one that has been of a great deal of concern to the NPA. The fact that in some divisions judges have recalled the victim to come and give evidence again, often a long time after the trial, and just the immensely traumatic impact that has had on the complainant. I'm happy to report that, there's been a lot of engagement between the NPA and the JGs on this issue, and I think that in KZN, where this has happened previously, the practice has essentially stopped now. In the Western Cape, that was one of the other divisions where it happened regularly. I think it has not happened for some time now, and I think the JP has dealt with the issue here, as well as in the Pretoria High Court, where it sometimes happens. So it's not... I'm not saying that it won't happen again in the future, but at least I think we have managed to take some measures to stop that part of the referral process. I also wanted just to highlight one of the issues around the transitional arrangements that's, again, not in our written submission. But the transitional provisions at the moment says that all cases that are with the High Court should be referred back to the Regional Court once the measures are positive, this amendment becomes law. There are lots of difficulties about that because in some cases the judges have already started reading the record, although they've not given judgment. Our suggestion would rather be to say that, practically I think from the NPA side, once the law looks like it's about to come in force, we can simply adjourn the proceedings in the Regional Court and resume it after, for sentencing after the law has come into effect. But practically, we would say that cases that are already in the High Court should rather stay there for finalization. We're worried about cases flowing to and fro and even getting lost in the process. But mainly to put all those cases back on the regional court rolls where there's already a substantial backlog and a huge caseload, I think would cause big logistical problems. So we would rather say complete the cases that are in the High Court. It's probably necessary that the transitional mechanism says that, so that there's no uncertainty about that part of it. I think one of the issues that was raised earlier, and perhaps we accept that there's some difficulty about it, but we do think that it is probably desirable to give some consideration to ensuring that more experienced magistrates deal with cases that where life imprisonment may potentially be imposed. We don't have a quick and easy answer because the truth of the matter is that there are a number of high courts where there would be no regional court magistrates with more than 5 years' experience, to use as an example. And one would then have logistical difficulties about trying the case somewhere else or bringing a magistrate in. But I think it is something that perhaps needs to be considered because especially newly appointed magistrates might just not have the right kind of experience or to deal with cases of this magnitude. But we'll leave that in the wise hands of the committee to try and find a solution to what is likely to be a fairly thorny difficulty there. I think that if one of my colleagues wants to add that to our discussion.
Thank you. Very useful. This last suggestion is something that emanated when we were discussing it with Adam's labor representative. And the big issue is clearly that what you're going to have, hopefully, is a prosecuting policy that will basically mean that all cases that are quite apparent up front, to which life sentences may accrue, would be prosecuted in the High Court. Problem, of course, by the very nature of the design of this legislation would be that it would only be those matters that eventually become apparent during the course of the trial that a life sentence may become appropriate that will actually be dealt with at the court. Now to then start saying no, only certain magistrates can, you know, because you won't know up front. That kind of creates a difficulty in that respect. And then the second issue, and you know, I mean, I think we must give some more thought to it, and if there are mechanisms that we can employ, it would be useful. I think part of the problem is that we haven't really spoken prior to this. So one of the things that we haven't made clear to you, as you point out in the legislation, is what our intention was with regard to empowering, giving you that clause, that empowering clause that allows you to then make discernible policy in regard to your prosecution initiative. And perhaps one of the things that we should consider a little more is the alternative. If we were to obviously prefer jurisdiction on the regional court. And the only reason, as I say, we're going that route is to deal with those cases that become apparent during the course of the trial. So we'll need to definitely look at that. The other issue that's obviously becoming a difficulty as we discuss and debate these matters is that you definitely will need a more nuanced approach in terms of the policy. Certainly, one of the things that we hope will come out of it is that most of your very serious cases will be prosecuted in the High Court. But at the same time, you want to obviate the possibility or the perception that every case that you're prosecuting in the regional court is in fact a less serious matter up front, so that if you have a rape matter that is proceeding in your regional court, that you don't have a general acceptance and a general perception that in fact it's one of those lesser crimes. And so for that reason you will need to have a more nuanced approach that would allow, for example, in cases where your high court simply cannot take more cases, even for those serious cases, to then be prosecuted at your regional court to alleviate the burden. So that they're both in mechanisms to ensure that we don't cause huge backlogs and so on. As far as the review is concerned, I think it's something that we, this committee must consider as an alternative or certainly as an option to the appeal. Given, of course, the fact that hopefully if the prosecuting policy is in place, that most of the serious matters that will prefer life is actually prosecuted at that level, you're talking about just very few number of cases at your regional court level that would again be visited by the automatic cure in this instance. But the fact that you will need two judges, for example, that does come into play, the whole issue of arguments and communications with legal aid and so on, are certainly factors to be considered. Although, as I say, my sense is that if we sort this thing out properly, we shouldn't have a huge deluge of appeals emanating from the regional court either. But it's something that we will consider and give some serious thought to, I imagine. Juveniles is something that I did want you to just talk to us a little bit about. The one aspect that has been recurring is the aspect of the application of minimum sentences on children. I'm not sure whether your submission finally deals with it, because I haven't read it. I know that in the previous draft that you did this to me, there was some mention of juveniles. I don't know if anybody wants to just take 2 minutes quickly and just tell us what the view of the NPA is on this matter.
Let me say that we, at the moment, we've only got a technical amendment, which has been on page 7 of our submission. That's only the issue of the accused person. So we've not commented further. The question at issue here is the Brandt judgment in the FCA, which interpreted a provision in the existing law to mean that in effect the law does not apply to persons between 16 and 18. So we have looked at the proposed amendment to which we think remedies that. We've not had a long time to, I mean, we've not considered this properly, let me say. But I think one of the considerations that we perhaps can put forward as the committee to look at is that whether the existing provision that there is in the law should not just be amended to remove the word decide, which I think is the issue on which this judgment turned, to confer a sort of unfettered discretion on the courts in regard to that 16 to 18. So, but I can't say that we can undertake that we'll go back and just look at this issue more properly and give you something in writing. We only became fully alerted to that issue in the course of today, so we've done some work, but nothing complete.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of what I was going to ask has been covered, but I just find some of the issues that came up earlier, the clauses, substantial compelling circumstances related to sexual offences in particular, you support those. There have been concerns expressed about the constitutionality of those. What are your views on that? And secondly, on the key relation to the relationship between the parties that was raised earlier in the day, have you found that in the cases of withdrawal, that was a concern whether the domestic relationship and the concern was spouse or a partner? If you have a minimum sentence of crime, they wouldn't want to prosecute. Obviously, you can prosecute, but there's a complainant wants to withdraw. That's the one point. And then I think answer raised the possibility of other rates being included under part two, where it's now part three. What is your view on that?
Okay, let's start from the back. I think we heard the proposal the first time today that consideration should be given to moving rape from part one to part two. I think
three to two.
So I think we could see some of the sense in that in terms of the huge gaps that were pointed out. Again, I think we could say that we will go back and just think through the implications of that properly. But it did seem to be sensible. I'm going to ask my colleague, Corky and Shedder, to comment on the issues of plea bargains or withdrawals of cases. And I think it is, I know personally about some of those cases which have become publicly controversial. And it is a really difficult issue for us in circumstances where the complainant does not want to pursue the matter, alternatively where it has a very severe impact within the family. I think in some of the ones that have become controversial, we've really looked at it from a national level to satisfy ourselves that what we've done was appropriate. I think in several of those cases, it was appropriate. I think in others, it was not always appropriate. But one does have to accept, I think, that the prosecutor dealing with the matter is often caught in a very difficult situation there where the case may just collapse if there's not, the prime witness is no longer willing to give evidence. But perhaps up Rodney the Cook will give us a...
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think that Billy has covered that issue. And it is difficult from a practical point of view to the extent that the complainant does not want to cooperate further in the actual prosecution of the matter. But our view is very clear that we start from the position that all cases must be prosecuted. And to that extent, our prosecutors are well trained to take those matters to court. As to the actual percentage of those cases, and where it is happening, I think it's something that we must go and look at in terms of our own stats to see to what extent that is a problem or that thing is coming through. But quite frankly, I'm not aware that it is a problem in this province that is occurring on a regular basis. But perhaps what we should do is to examine it in terms of our own stats, in respect of our withdrawals, and come back to the committee with a better answer in terms of actual persistence to the chief of that.
To can do that, maybe one needs to comment that the prosecutors, on the basis of some other factors like public interest, are discouraged from just withdrawing this type of case. We do attend to them in a similar way as we do in the case of domestic violence cases, when you say the prosecutor should not just withdraw without the approval of somebody senior, be it an SCP or the DPP. But we don't have such a direct stipulation in as far as these other matters are concerned, that is the rape matter. but we do discourage prosecutors and we say, if it is in the interest of the society, then that matter must go on. But like Rodney just said, practically there are those problems where you find that the complainant insists and he says, look, this person is the only breadwinner. If you force me that the case must go on, then I'm not going to testify. Or if I'm going to testify, then I'm going to say that you don't want to hear. But such cases are very, very, very few.
But the issue that was raised earlier around plea bargaining of minimum sentences, I mean, there is the approach from what I hear you say, there is the approach that a prosecutor, individual prosecutor, would need to refer back to a higher authority within the NPA before you could plea bargain on a minimum sentence, not this rate.
Any. No offense where 105A comes in. In fact, not any professor can do that. Seniors like an SCP have got the delegated powers and the justice and the like. Then they will look into it and you can also say, look, no people in this type of a matter. That will be it.
Can I just add here that in those cases where the determination of substantial and compelling circumstances have to be made, in respect of plea bargaining, those cases must be referred to the DCP for the decision. And in our jurisdiction, once again, and I could use this possibly as a measure in terms of the other areas as well, it doesn't happen that often. And where we have to make that determination, obviously it's done very seriously and we look at all the factors before we agree to any plea bargain. We certainly don't adopt the approach of the plea bargain away, or to a lenient sentence. We rather prefer, in these cases, to proceed with the prosecution. There's no incentive for us to want to agree to a plea bargain simply to get rid of the case. Serious cases, our view is that those cases, normally, particularly in the right matters, go to court. Of course, you have cases where there are children and where there are vulnerable witnesses, and even witnesses that children who can't testify. And often that information is available to us. And so there, often the only option is really to try and reach a plea bargain. And it becomes difficult in terms of how we try to get that like a finalized by ensuring that the accused is actually sent to jail. And that could be the objective of the moment.
The issue of children then brings us to yet another complicating factor in this legislation, which is in part one, we have the crime of a rape of a child, which is very strongly. Now, from what I can ascertain, the real infrastructure to deal with child witnesses and so on actually exists at your regional court level, your specialized courts and your intermediaries and your cameras and so on. Again, that's going to mean some kind of nuanced deviation within the policy that you can finally adopt. So that clearly in those provinces where, and I guess it would be most provinces where it's more appropriate to then proceed in regional court, notwithstanding the possibility of life, that would also need to be considered and factored into. Because clearly, the High Court may not have those facilities, and certainly you regional courts in front of you tend to have experienced prosecutors and experienced judicial officers who are particularly assigned to deal with very special kinds of so it's something to also take note of. But thank you very much. Yes.
We haven't responded to Mr. Swart's other question.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was the other question?
I'll answer it anyway. But he asked us about the constitutionality of whether we have any concerns about those things that are said not to constitute compelling circumstances. I think we have not had any particular concern about that matter. We haven't sort of done deep research on it, but it doesn't strike us as something that we, think is constitutionally sensitive. So, in our view at the moment, that shouldn't be a problem. Perhaps I also just had one oversight to note that I didn't introduce our delegation. But I just wanted to say, for those who may not know, Paul Piem chairs the head of the National Prosecution Service. Rodney de Kock is the Director of Public Prosecutions in Cape Town. Taljani Tele is the Special Director in the NDPP's office, and Gerard Nel is the sort of legal advisor in the NPA.
So we know who to blame for, you know who to blame when crimes don't get prosecuted. Okay. I see they've got, I don't know whether they dye their hair, but one of them, or two of them, have got very grey hair. So there's questions like that, that's obviously as a result of that. Thanks. What we will do is obviously invite you to, once you have considered some of these aspects that you've told us about, and if you do want to make further submissions, that will be available to you as usual. And in particular, I think on this matter of the substantial and compelling, once you get the information from this one of the entities who have undertaken to come back to us, I think we should also share it with you and see what your comments are about specifically the issue of relationships and so on. Because clearly they were pointing to a double-edged sword there, and we'd love to hear from you on that. But thank you very much, and thank you very much particularly for addressing some of these issues at the very last minute's notice. From Ms. Galinetti. Is that the submission that you'll be speaking to? Oh, lovely. Okay. Please, okay. Can we just settle down at the back? Thank you very much. Please proceed, Professor. And welcome to you, Sally.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee. I'm here representing the Child Justice Alliance, which is an organization consisting of over 400 members and friends, either from civil society, concerned individuals, as well as a large number of NGOs associated with the development of South Africa's child justice system, which has been ongoing since the beginning of the 1990s. In that regard, I have a feeling of deja vu as I sit here today. I'm having addressed this very same portfolio committee on this very same issue, namely children in minimum sentences, 10 years ago. I've been asked by the Child Justice Alliance to represent the Alliance in the presentation of aspects of this petition today. And I'm very heartened to hear that the issue of children in minimum sentences was raised in relation to the previous presentation. And I would like to commence then with a brief discussion of the Brunt case that was referred to by Mr. Hoffman, and to explain why it is that our submission of 10 years ago was in fact followed in the Brunt decision in the Supreme Court of Appeal in a unanimous decision of 5 judges, and thereafter endorsed in the subsequent case, the case of GPP versus P, although that wasn't the case that attracted a minimum sentence by virtue of the fact that the accused, in respect of whom the appeal was being prosecuted, was not under the age of 16 at the time of commission of the offence. Nevertheless, in a strongly worded judgment, the court came with a majority of 5 endorsing the decision, so we've now got 10 of the Supreme Court of Appeal judges agreeing that the imposition of the minimum sentence upon a child aged under 18 is a contravention of Section 28(1)(g) of the Constitution, in particular in respect of the fact that Section 28(1)(g) requires the imposition of a sentence for the shortest appropriate period of time. And the imposition of a minimum sentence is by definition not the shortest appropriate period of time, because that can only be determined with reference to the individualization of the case, the age of the accused, the nature of the offense, and so forth. As I have said on many occasions to my students, thank you for being here this afternoon, some of you, there is no legal impediment to a judge imposing a life sentence or a 20-year sentence or a 25-year sentence on any child aged under 18 or even aged under 16 in appropriate and suitable circumstances. That might be challenged on appeal, but there's no legal impediment to doing so. The problem constitutionally speaking lies in the fact that a prescribed sentence is by definition a sentence that is full foul of Section 28(1)(g) of the Constitution. In our elaborating jurisprudence of the Supreme Court of Appeal, the Constitutional Court, and other high courts around the country, we've also seen great attention paid to Section 28(2) of the Constitution, specifically in the realm of sentencing. And it has been said now quite categorically that the best interest of the child principle has become an additional sentencing principle in our law by virtue of the operation of Section 28(2). That aspect is highlighted in our written submission, so I won't repeat that. The written submission of the Child Justice Alliance is therefore fairly clear that the application of the minimum sentence to persons aged 16 or 17 is constitutionally suspect. And I do have to say that this is not merely a technical correction of something that could be effected in order to cure the legislation of some defects. It is a constitutional matter. To turn to further support for the position, I must alert the Portfolio Committee to the developments at the level of international law, and in particular to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which we have ratified and in respect of which we are bound. And I have to also note that the Convention on the Rights of the Child and its associated documents have played a leading role in forming the jurisprudence of our courts in relation to a large number of issues, but also juvenile sentencing. We have been greatly assisted in the understanding of the rights required by the Convention on the Rights of the Child by the adoption by the Committee of General Comment No. 10 in February of 2007, which elaborates children's rights in juvenile justice, what the Committee expects a juvenile justice system to deliver in respect of member states' parties, rule number 196 in the world. In relation to life imprisonment, I would alert the committee to paragraph 77 of the general comment, which is I have with me,
The committee, after reviewing the provision of the convention that deals specifically with life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, which is section 37, continues to note that it reminds state parties which do sentence children to life imprisonment with the possibility of release or parole that this sanction must fully comply with the aims of juvenile justice enshrined in Article 40. This means that there must be regular review of the child's development and progress in order to decide on possible release. Given the likelihood that the life imprisonment of a child will make it very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the aims of juvenile justice despite the possibility of release, the committee strongly recommends state parties to abolish all forms of life imprisonment for offences committed by persons under the age of 18. That's a very strongly worded recommendation to state parties, and obviously is one which will be taken up with this country when we, at some point in the future, fulfill our reporting obligations under the Convention on the Rights of the Child. I would also like to alert the Portfolio Committee to the provisions of paragraph 38 of the General Comments, which reminds state parties that where they have different rules for 16 and 17-year-olds, or lower in some instances, and that in effect creates a two-tier juvenile justice system which entrenches discrimination. And these provisions would again fall foul of that particular principle contained in General Comment number 10. My final contribution relates not so much to the imposition of sentence issues, which I think are carefully elaborated in Ms. Gallinetti's submission, the written submission, but I would like to just allude to one additional issue, and that in the draft sentencing law relates to Clause 4, which deals with the appeal procedures. While we welcome as an alliance the fact that the age of 16 is replacing the age of 14 and 18 the age of 16, in some respects we would urge that the Convention on the Rights of the Child is quite clear that the right to appeal should be accorded to all children under 18 who are convicted of an offence, and we are reminded again of this obligation in paragraph 60 and 61 of General Comment, which clarifies that the right to appeal is not just for minor cases, but should be preserved for all serious cases as well. And we would argue that this limitation of the right to appeal is a violation of our international obligations. Thank you. And then I would also like to inquire when the Child Justice Bill is coming to Parliament. I am told by Dr. Lowe, and we haven't finalized our research in this regard, and by the way, thank you for that. We're obviously aware of the transgression. Do you also agree that Brunt leaves the door open for minimum sentences to apply to 16 to 18 years accused under the age of 18 and above the age of 16 under certain circumstances?
I don't agree that Brunt leaves the door open to the application of the provisions of Act 105 of 1997. What I do agree is that a sentencing court, in terms of the general provisions of the Criminal Procedure Act, is entitled to impose any sentence,
that's fine,
including a sentence of life imprisonment.
No, I'm talking specifically about Brunt.
Yep.
Brunt, there's a phrase in Brunt that Dr. Lowe has pointed out to me that reads as follows, and maybe you want to just look at that as well. It interprets the words decides to impose, the clause that has now been proposed to be completely deleted, as an option left for the court to decide under those circumstances, in those categories, in other words, 16 to 18, as to whether or not to impose the minimum sentence. Will you have a look at that and just let me know what it is that you think? Because if that is the case, then it makes a substantial difference in the approach
of the court. Clearly, in that case, they veered to not dealing with the minimum sentences and veering away from it. So they opted out of that discretion. But that it does leave the door open is what is of interest to me at this stage. The second thing that I'd like to just also ask is in line, obviously the section in the Constitution, particularly the, and I imagine when you say that the constitutional difficulties with what we're proposing in the legislation, the issue of obviously it's not applying only to children under 16. The constitutional difficulty, I imagine, would relate to the issue of first instance. In other words, minimum sentences based on first instance and not last resort. And it's on that basis that there would be a constitutional difficulty based on the clause in the Constitution. However, that particular clause comes from the International Convention.
Yes, Section 281G actually contains two aspects. The one is that detention is a matter of last resort. And the second part is that when used must be for the shortest appropriate period of time.
So both of those things come from the Convention.
They both come from Article 57 of the Convention. And I've chosen to focus my presentation today not on detention as a matter of first resort, on last resort, because I assume that the cases that we're talking about are cases that are involve serious offences where detention is going to be an issue anyway.
Yes.
That is not the offending aspect of
the lowest.
It's not the shortest period of time because it is a prescribed sentence.
So won't that, in any case, at the age of the accused person, be a substantial and compelling circumstance allowing for a deviation of sentence?
I don't think one can assume that at all, that if persons of that age are included in the legislation, that alerts the sentence to the fact that age is not a substantial and compelling circumstance. In all respects. So that is why one found in the period 1997 until the first decision started coming through the High Court that minimum sentences were in fact routinely imposed upon 16 and 17 year olds.
The proper interpretation of the Constitution should allow that kind of interpretation to be facilitated at the time that such a matter is adjudicated when it is raised.
But I think the preferable route would be to exclude under 18-year-olds from the ambit of the legislation and then to allow for the fact that there might be the isolated case where a judge or a sentencing officer will want to impose a very serious sentence, taking into account the usefulness of the offender, whether that person is then aged under 18 or not.
Shortest possible period could also include a life sentence in certain circumstances.
I admit to the possibility that, according to the decision in Brunt, there is a technical possibility that as short as possible cases could be a life sentence. However, I would argue that the Committee on the Rights of the Child has correctly identified the fact that very seldom, if ever, will a sentence of that nature comply with the basic aims of the juvenile justice system, which includes the eventual reintegration of the child by then very adult back into the community. And for that reason, the committee has asked for the abolition of the sentence of life imprisonment.
I'm told that, and the reason I was asking whether those two factors in the Constitution emanate from the international conventions, I'm told that, and as I say, we're still finalizing our research in this regard, that there are other signatory countries to those conventions who nonetheless require mandatory sentence. In other words, not even sentences with the discretion in the way that they're formulated, but mandatory sentences specifically for juveniles. Have you encountered those, and if so, what under what circumstances do they operate under?
There are instances of countries that have mandatory sentencing regimes, but they differ very vastly from country to country, and they're not very many. In Australia, the Committee on the Rights of the Child was fiercely critical of the mandatory sentencing regime for short-term sentences, 14 days for stealing a box of cocaine samples. land preemptivism. It's a very different from the kind of regime that's being envisaged here. And according to a Human Rights Watch study that was released last year, which I unfortunately don't have with me, South Africa is one of, I think, only four countries in the world that permits the sentence of life imprisonment for a person under the age of 18.
But it is true that in principle, then, you have a
Thank you.
And then the second point of Terry's mention is that they're not really talking from the point of view of the child that's lying about the role they form. In terms of 16 and 17 years of the kids, I think there are some problems. I think it's a case that I referred to earlier, the case of Jesus, where he is illustrated just such an unusual case as where a father of permission to me to recently bring up a grandmother. And this is the point that my main connection with you is that you have to look at the context and the reality of that person being rehabilitated in the society. It will take the time to accommodate which in the case of the good I'm referring to the sentencing case is this. Both of these proposed as the and the patient that requires the major study at the level of the Supreme Court of Appeal is different. So that is clearly the issue, it's not the level we owe people, that it will not be a case of involving their foundation ability, but it's the change in the care that to come out and all the life of people, which is what we all want at the end of the day. A sentence of 25 years imposed on a 16-year-old woman to result in the release of a 41-year-old who is not necessarily rehabilitated, yet that person is released after the minimum non-parole period. What I want to do is to make the conflict of the release a goal worth achieving for the young person, something to come after and to try for. Thank you.